Support for KNKX comes from WSECU, offering 3 new Visa credit cards and 3 new checking accounts. WSECU's goal is to help make the right card make a difference. More information is available at WSECU.org. WSECU, serving Washington since 1957.
I would say we have almost everything except the forearm. We have nothing that we've seen so far that's a hand. And then we have not so much that is part of the skull. We have some of the beak, and we have some of the top of the skull, but not everything else.
Hey, I'm Gabriel Spitzer. This is Sound Effect on KNKX, and I'm hanging out at the Burke Museum in Seattle with Christian Sedor. He's showing me some 220 million year old bones.
Yeah, so shuvasaurids are a really strange type of animal. They've only been known for about 20 years or so, and for most of that time, we really had only one example. When they were first described, they were actually thought to be relatives of dinosaurs. But then you get down to some details of the ankle bones, and that's where you can really tell that this animal is actually a crocodile relative as opposed to a dinosaur relative.
This is probably one of the most complete skeletons of one of these things in the entire world. But it's still missing a bunch of stuff, which in paleontology is pretty much par for the course.
All of these bones, for the most part, have disarticulated. And so that means that the skeleton is not preserved like a roadkill. It's actually like you put it into a blender and dumped it all out in a slurry at the end. And so that's what we're finding in this quarry, is we're finding a gooey matrix that has hardened up. You know, some of them are lying flat, some of them are vertical. So there's about 25 of them, but their skeletons are completely jumbled together.
So how common is it in paleontology to have pieces missing from a specimen? What that you find?
I would say the vast majority of the time, you very rarely get the entire skeleton.
When you have an incomplete skeleton, what have paleontologists and curators done to fill in the gaps?
What we're doing with a lot of this material is we're actually scanning it in some way. And so it could either be a surface scan, which would be either a laser scan or a light scanner, or we actually put it into a CT machine and then we print the model that way.
So this is one of two printers we have here at the Burke. This one we call Printy McPrintface. That was named by students. And the other is our Burke bot.
This human is Meredith Riven. She's a collections manager and keeper of the 3D printers. Printy McPrintface here is working on a mammoth right now, while its cousin prints shuvasaurid bones in another building. Meredith picks up a lumpy off-white bone to show me the kind of stuff it can do.
This is humerus of a dolphin ancestor, and it's a holotype, so we have just one specimen, and this particular specimen is also going to be 3D reconstructed so that we can hang it from the ceiling. When you have a one-of-a-kind specimen, you don't necessarily want to hang it from the ceiling, so that's what we're doing with this individual.
It used to be that when you had empty spaces in a skeleton, you'd pay a sculptor to fashion the missing pieces out of plaster. Now researchers are more and more just printing the pieces they need. And unless you happen to be a sculptor, that's had a bunch of benefits.
I think from a research perspective, it's probably the scans that are the most useful. And so that's a digital file that we can send anywhere in the world and share with colleagues instantly. We have been shipping specimens back and forth, but of course that always comes with some risk. And sometimes things get damaged, even lost in the mail. And so we try to avoid that as much as possible.
And I would guess that that means the museum in China could then take your scan and print their own copy.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. We hope to be able to do that eventually, that some of these, especially things like mammoths, that we can just share them with classrooms and teachers will be able to print out mammoths with their students.
Whoa, you could just download a mammoth.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, and it's especially powerful if it's a mammoth that came from your town.
So much of paleontology is like putting together a 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle when 3/4 of the pieces got lost, say a 250 million years ago. But Christian Sedor says the printing technology is letting them see the whole picture come together in new ways.
We've been working at this quarry for 5 years, and there are certain elements that are just, for whatever reason, maybe they're really fragile, or maybe we just haven't had the eye for them. But this last couple of years, I've said, okay, these are the bones that we don't have in this display. These are the ones we need. And We actually were able to come up with a couple of really great bones this summer. So for example, this little calcaneum, we didn't have one of these before, but this is one of the heel bones. It was broken in the field before we got there, but we'll 3D scan it and then we'll print another side to actually have it for the specimen for the mount.
Today on Sound Effect, our theme is missing pieces, stories of the lengths people will go to fill in the gaps in the puzzle, whether that's a skeleton or a collection or a family. Stick around. I recently headed up to South Camino Island to visit artist Jack Gunter at his studio gallery.
It's about a 5,000 square foot chamber, and it's filled with the first lights after Edison invented the light bulb. It's filled with Frank Lloyd Wright original furniture and maybe 2,000 of my paintings.
While I was there, Jack showed me a particular series of paintings.
Okay, well, here's one where there's a 747 going straight down and a 5 foot by 4 foot painting, and it's coming straight down and going to crash into Helen's kitchen because Helen pissed me off. And I crashed into her 8 times in this series. Here's one of
these paintings were missing from Jack's collection for 25 years. They were trapped half a world away, waiting for Jack to take a crazy, winding journey to recover them. Before we get to that, a little background on Jack Gunter. Before he discovered art, he got his PhD in organic chemistry. He published books and produced films. By the early 80s, he was teaching art to middle schoolers, despite having no art experience whatsoever. So he decided to give painting a whirl himself.
And I went home and said, I'm going to try a painting. And I tried a painting, and it was really, really good, and I was astonished. I said, Jesus, I'm a painter.
Jack threw himself into the art world, and he was busily creating until one fateful day.
I was at an antique show down in the town of Brimfield, about 100 miles away, on a weekend, sleeping under my truck. And they woke me up and said, oh, we're so glad you're alive, because the city block you had your apartment in burned down, the whole city block. People died. They said, don't even go home. There's just a big piece of tape around the whole block. And I was on the fourth floor, and people later said that they stood on the sidewalk and looked up through the fourth floor windows and saw my paintings burning on the walls. So I came back to just nothing. My son asked me after the fire, I had painted like 5 beautiful paintings of him. He said, all my paintings burned up. Does that mean I'm going to die? And I said, well, no, John, the paintings have nothing to do with your life and your great life ahead of you. And I had lost 2 other series of paintings in the same year from another fire. So basically, I just figured I was sort of, my paintings were not cursed, but they were destined to go away. I had no trust of permanence at all. So I had a dog and a pickup truck, and I decided I wanted to go out and try my luck out west.
It took Jack a while before he could create again.
Well, I couldn't paint for 7 years. I really didn't trust the permanency of any of my work. I couldn't even point to anything to say I was a painter.
Jack settled in Stanwood, Washington. He eased back into art, painting versions of the stories old-timers in the neighborhood would tell. Around then, SeaTac Airport was planning for a new third runway. They were considering a handful of locations, including Jack's new home, Stanwood.
So the debate went on, and I decided that I was going to do a series of paintings about the effect an airport would have to Stanwood. And I was one of the people that did not want the airport. So since I was painting now, I did a whole series of paintings where airplanes were crashing into Stanwood in various fashions. And I took everything that Stanwood liked, and I crashed a 747 into it.
SeaTac did not wind up building in Stanwood. Helen's kitchen was safe. But Jack's paintings got some unexpected attention.
And one day, the head of the newspaper, the Stanwood Commander News, came over, and he had 6 Russians with him. the end of the wall and communism was sort of looming ahead, and this group of Russian business people decided to come over and make some economic partnerships and a little peace reach. So the Russian in charge said, how would you like to come to the Soviet Union and exhibit your paintings? About a month later, I get a letter from him, and he says, yes, I'm inviting you to come to Russia, or Soviet Union at the time. So I invited another buddy of mine who was a wonderful, crazy, naive artist. And so we ended up in Moscow. But we had no official documents. And this was not the Russian government offering us a show in Russia. This is eight citizens saying, come on over and we'll get you some art shows. And they saw all these big crates and said, what is this? They said, you cannot come in with these. And so Valerian finally leaped over the customs gate, and now he's into the customs area where we are, and he's yelling at these guys in Russian, and they're yelling back, and he says, Dan, you stay here with the paintings? Jack, come with me. And so he takes me up to the third floor at the airport, and this woman up there takes three carbons, puts them in a typewriter, cranks them together, and he looks at me, Valerian, said, are you a member of a political organization? And I said, I'm a member of the Stanwood-Siberian Cultural Exchange, which is a group I made up right there in her office. And she heard that, and she said, хорошо. And now we got in with the paintings. Well, the plan was we were going to have three museum shows. Dan and I left and went back to the United States, and the paintings were going to go to two other museums in the year that I was gone. And the plan was that I'd come back in a year and I'd get them and pack them home and go back to the United States.
During that year, the world changed. The wall came down, the Soviet Union was dissolving, and into that turmoil, Jack trekked back to Russia to get his paintings.
We flew out to Siberia and spent some time in Novosibirsk again with Valerian. And I kept waiting to see where my paintings were. I said, I want to see my paintings. She said, no problem. We will see your paintings later. I said, yeah, but I'm going to leave in a couple of days. I'd like to make sure they're okay. I want to make sure everything's fine. No problem. So 2 days before leaving, I'm still wondering where my paintings are. And Valerian said, we have a problem. He said, the Russian customs agent that we met last year is missing. We've been trying to find him for 3 weeks. That's why you haven't seen your paintings. We can't find him. He has all your paperwork that was recorded when you came here last year. And he says, you cannot take your paintings home. I said, what do you mean? They're my paintings. They're all signed on the bottom. He said, they're in big crates. Your signature will mean nothing, and you will not leave the airport without documentation. There's nothing we could do, and there's nothing he could do. And now my paintings are stuck in Siberia somewhere in the basement of a museum.
Jack returned home empty-handed, but he refused to give up.
Now, the problem was that back then, the internet was just starting. The phone service in Siberia was pretty sketchy. And every once in a while, I'd try to call Valerian up to see if there's any change in the policy. And there was no way to reach him by the internet. His name was Valerian Ivanchenko, which means Val, son of John. It's like Smith. There's 10 billion Ivanchenkos in Russia. And after about 10 years, I just gave up.
Years turned to decades, and almost 25 years went by since Jack's first trip to the Soviet Union.
And now it was 2013, 2014, and one day on Facebook, I see this message in Cyrillic. I can read Russian language pretty well. And it was my friend Valerian. And so I sort of half-translated it, and there were some English words in there, and I said, oh my God, you're alive, you're here. Are my paintings okay? So a week later, I get another message back from him that says, they're fine. And then I reached out again and said, is the paperwork fixed? And a week later, I hear, no, but you're welcome to try. So I raised $5,000, and I was determined to get a film crew to come with me now. And I found two real good filmmakers, and they both said, sure.
All right, Jack. So is someone meeting us at the airport when we land in Siberia?
I sure hope so.
Is the Novosibirsk airport near the city?
I really doubt it.
Okay. How about a place to stay when we get there? Anything lined up?
1989, he got us places to stay. I'm assuming he's got something lined up.
Okay.
Valerian did meet Jack at the airport, and off they went to the basement of the Novosibirsk Museum. After a quarter century, most of Jack's paintings were still there.
How was quality?
It looks good. It's fine. It's as bright as it was painted the first day.
Yeah.
There is the plumbers at Helen's Kitchen. I see a little bit of damage here. I can fix this. These are easy repairs. This happens just in any transit. This is a big moment for me, Valerian. 25 years of my dream is right here at this minute.
After a series of detours and dead ends, Jack managed to scrape the collection back together. But he still had one old foe to contend with: Russian red tape.
Now, it's a little deja vu all over again here. We're one day from getting my paintings home. He says it's all fixed, there's no problem. This is the same day that happened 24 years ago. They said, oh, there's a problem. There's a problem with the paperwork. So we're not out of this yet. Now, he has to go to another thing. He says there's another issue.
We'll try to do all this.
What I want to do is get my paintings home. That's the most important thing.
I know. And we are working hard to...
Jack and Valerian figure out a workaround, though it's one that completely taps out Jack's bank account. The last bit of suspense on the trip is waiting to see if his credit card will clear.
And the credit card machine goes, which I said, that's a good sound. That sounds like it's spitting out a receipt. And so basically, all the money I had in the world now paid for that DHL shipment. And 6 days later, it showed up in Stanwood. It was surreal. And I opened them up one at a time, all 17 of them. And that was the first time that the light of American sunshine had fallen on these paintings for a quarter of a century. I think that I became a stronger artist, and you heard that I have a problem with loss. And if you go back and think about it, here's another loss. After my fire, after the other fire, I bring paintings to Russia, and they're lost again. And that was almost like just sort of proof that no matter what I do, I will not end up with my own work because it'll disappear. And it was a little bit of a resurrectance for me to finally realize that it wasn't lost. And with enough initiative and enough luck and enough blessings, that sometimes you can get your stuff back after loss. So sometimes the loss is the most important part of your life, because where you move after the loss is maybe a place you wouldn't have gone to if you hadn't had that loss. And I went ahead and I painted 4,000 paintings when I came back brokenhearted. My life went on, but having them now sort of just sort of completes a piece of my life that I thought was gone forever.
Jack Gunter is an artist on Kamino Island. You can see images of some of his paintings at our website, knkxsoundeffect.org. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. This is Sound Effect, and today our theme is missing pieces. The missing pieces that have defined Natalie Virginia's life are parts of her family. Natalie lives in Tacoma now. She grew up in the Democratic Republic of Congo with her twin sister, her younger sister and brother, and her parents.
When I was born, I was happy. My mom was a teacher. My dad was a principal. We had like everything a child can dream to have. But when I turned 7, I lost my parents in the war. And that's how I end up in an orphanage.
A quick warning, this story contains some disturbing descriptions of war and violence. By the early 2000s, the long-raging civil war in Congo was officially winding down, but all over the country, pockets of fighting continued. Natalie was used to the cycles of conflict.
like since I was a child, every time they would shoot, and we would run and come back in the house. Sometimes we would go like a week and come back home. But in 2007, that's where it get worse.
One day at school, the teachers abruptly sent everyone home. Natalie fled to another village with her grandmother and waited to hear from her parents. There was no word from them.
United Nations would say people need to go back home. We went back home. Things are smelling so bad, like because people get killed in the street and bodies, everything, the dogs are eating the bodies. Everything was really bad. Until now, sometimes when I sleep, I still see it in my dream. So and that's how when we get home, we waited, my dad is going to come, my mom is going to come, no one never show up.
Natalie says her grandmother died soon after. Her uncle was summoned to care for her and her three siblings. And then things took an even darker turn.
He did a lot of things to me. A lot. I don't know what to say. He wasn't. A lot of things.
The stories of those things are not for the faint of heart. Natalie says her uncle wanted her parents' property and was eager to get the children out of the way. One day, Natalie had to take her little sister to the doctor and left her twin sister, Gato, behind.
When I tried to come back, my sister did not show up. So I waited. She did not show up. After a week, I started telling my neighbors what happened. And my neighbor say, I'm going to tell you, but please don't say because I can get killed. I won't say anything. He told me, I saw your uncle killing your sister this side. I went to see the body is already animals, you know, eating her. So that's what happened to them. So when I think about it, I don't know if to forgive him. It's really hard for me.
People in the village took Natalie in, passing her from house to house. She was only 10 years old, which was too young to apply for asylum. So Natalie was separated from her younger siblings and wound up in orphanages for almost 6 years.
I never had a childhood like other kids.
When she was 15, Natalie was able to apply for refugee status, and she ended up in Tacoma, where she was placed in foster care. But rather than salvation, Natalie says she found more struggles, worse in some ways than surviving as an orphan and refugee in Africa.
I moved three houses, which is really difficult because one house I lived in, it was difficult. They don't want me to communicate with white people. They say, oh, white people did this. And it was really hard for me to be able to live there because I thought I just left my country because of the tribalism in French we say. But I can't come back here and someone tell me this. And all my friends' high school was white.
She was placed in a new home in Spanaway, but she says the family only spoke Spanish, and that made daily life into a grind. Then it was a third house in far-off rural Pierce County.
Where I live, there is no bus. I can't go to my friend. I can't go to work without no one taking me. I realize I can't stay there when I need to finish my school. When I go to school, it will take me 2.5 hours. It was like crazy. So when I turned 18, I moved to live my own.
Just 2 years after arriving in the U.S., Natalie started an independent life. But she says she wasn't prepared for just how abruptly the foster care system would cut her off. No more access to her social worker, no follow-up.
Our foster mothers, it's not like they're there to help us. They're also on the paycheck. It's a job for them. Because a lot of kids, when they are done foster care, they are being thrown like dogs. Like even dogs here have value than a foster care kid.
Still, Natalie managed to enroll in community college and got a job at Home Depot. And while she was there, she met a guy named Matthew.
I told him my problems. So he told me, I'm going to tell my mom to see if my mom can help you. So, and he went home, and his mom said yes. So I went there. He said that it's true. If something happened, I'm responsible. And then I went to live with her.
Natalie says meeting Patricia Hemphill was a major turning point. Patricia opened her house to Natalie, helped her with money and with schoolwork. And most importantly, Natalie says she asked for nothing in return. For the first time in the United States, this teenager who grew up way too fast had found a mother.
I wouldn't do anything like her child. I wouldn't. Sometimes I would drive her crazy, and she would. Sometimes she get mad, and in 2 minutes, I'm back in the phone calling her. And
I'll just mention that as we're talking, Patricia is looking on from a nearby chair.
That's how we have been. So she have been my mother since then. Yeah.
Patricia preferred not to be interviewed, but she and Natalie exchanged knowing looks. Patricia was also crucial in helping Natalie create this space that we're talking in. It's a clothing store in Lakewood called Undeniable Bajinia.
And this is Congolese fabric.
Natalie's surname means a wealthy, respected person, and she wanted to honor it in the name of her store.
I love America, and God knows, but their fabric is over manipulated.
She had learned to sew in Congo, and now she creates these vibrant garments of cotton and wool, dresses and jackets and handbags that combine French fashion with African colors and American styles.
I love it, sewing. Like, sometimes when I do it, it would take my stress away. I don't have to think, oh, this is what happened to me. This is what, I just have to focus for that thing.
Now she sells clothes to paying customers, including her professors, her lawyer, and of course, Patricia. But this place is more than a business. Natalie says she wanted to create a space where she could help other foster kids, where they could learn skills and also have a boss who understands what they're going through.
3 years ago, I had in my head, I wanted to teach kids how to sew. I want to teach them skills, like if you fall, you can't finish school, you can use your hands to be able to make something.
Now Natalie, all of 22 years old, is helping other foster kids fill in the gaps in their own families. She's opened up her own home to them, becoming, in effect, a mother herself.
They didn't have a home to stay. But because they know Natalie had a home, they came home, they told me, Natalie, please. I lived with them 7 months without paying nothing, helping them to get a job, because me, I already know how to apply for the job. And since now, every time when they have a problem, they always call me and say, Natalie, you still a mother to us, you know? So I feel like I helped them to be stronger.
And there's one more family Natalie has found in Tacoma. In the group of immigrants who gathered to sing together as the Tacoma Refugee Choir, Natalie has even co-written a song for them that she calls Everybody Needs Love.
I wrote that song because of Patricia. I thought about it, everybody needs love, because when she gave me love, I felt that I could do anything. So what I was missing was love. So it doesn't matter where you came from, we all need love.
Natalie Bajinia lives in Tacoma. You can find out more about her store and her story at knkxsoundeffect.org. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today our show is about missing pieces. Paula Johnson Burke is an archaeologist in Seattle. Her job is to collect pieces of artifacts and documents and see what story they tell about our past. One project that started out as a pretty mundane job a few years ago has grown into a personal obsession for Paula. It involves some stones, a Japanese immigrant who lived a very full life, and a form of simple poetry called sendu. Sound Effect producer Jennifer Wing tells us more.
A large oblong stone covered in brambles in the backyard of a house in Seattle's International District that was going to be torn down was Paula Johnson Burke's first introduction to a man named Shinjiro Honda. The stone, it weighed over 100 pounds. It was in its natural state, rough, but it was carved. On one side of it, there was a script in Japanese kanji. On the other side, there was a message carved in English.
The English side said, Shinjiro Honda, age 65, died September 3rd, 1942. The kanji side had a little bit more information that he had come from a certain province in Japan, and that that it said, this is the grave of Shinjiro Honda.
Paula needed to find out if there was a body buried underneath this rock or if there were ashes.
One of the children who had sold the house said, no, it was just a memorial stone to honor my dad's poetry teacher.
So there weren't any remains here, but Paula wanted to know more. Who was this man who taught poetry, who inspired someone to go through the trouble of erecting and carving a stone in his name? She started looking through old census records and learned that during World War II, Shinjiro Honda was sent to the Heart Mountain internment camp in Powell, Wyoming.
They are an interpretive center now, and they interpret the history of the Japanese internment during World War II. And they also had a stone. It was carved in three portions of the rock. And so one side said something about who had erected the stone, and it was the Poetry Society that had formed during the Japanese-American people's time there. And then the third side had a poem. I was just really starting to become a little more interested in who is this guy that all these stones, what is up with all these stones?
If you were to cross paths with Shinjiro Honda in Seattle back in the 1930s, you would have encountered a man who, at first glance, was part of the workforce that kept hotels and wealthy households running.
I'm sure they saw a servant. He worked as a cook in a hotel. He worked as a cook in a private home for many years. Shinjiro Honda most likely worked 6 days a week.
But as the stones revealed, there was much more than cooking for wealthy white people going on in this man's life. In fact, Paula discovered that there is a third stone dedicated to Shinjiro Honda. It's in Seattle's Lakeview Cemetery, and his remains aren't here either. But like the stone in Wyoming, a poem is etched into the rock, and this one, it's not as weathered, it's easier to read.
To live, that is good. But to die, released from care, is that not good too?
Shinjiro Honda was a highly respected artist in the Japanese immigrant community. He was a master of a type of poetry called sendu. It's similar to haiku. It's short, 3 lines and 17 syllables.
There were poems about using chopsticks in a fork world and things like that. Just very evocative images of like contrasting what it's like to be a foreigner in another land. He started basically organizing these poetry slams, if you will. So it was a group of people would get together and they would say their poems, and the crowd would vote with like their cheers, I guess, of who won that poetry slam. He was getting so much done in the same 24 hours that you and I have, but also working 6 days a week.
In the 1930s, Shinjiro Honda was one of the organizers of a sendu poetry symposium in Seattle. Poems from this event were published in Japan as an anthology. Paula tracked down one copy of this book at the University of Washington's Special Collections Library, which is where we meet up with Wakai McLean, a native Japanese speaker.
I'd like to help Paula as much as I can today.
A librarian produces a small green book.
This is the book. It's little. Oh my gosh.
Each page looks like a grid, filled with kanji, katakana, and hiragana. Each row is one brief poem. Some pages have as many as 12 poems.
What is this about here?
Oh, these are the people's names, member names.
With the help of Wakai translating for us, we learn that the book's prologue tells the story about when these Japanese writers first met and how the Sendu Poetry Group grew during the 1920s and early 1930s, and that it was the first of its kind in North America. Some poets sent in their work from as far away as the territory of Alaska. As Wakai reads through this tiny script, she gives a translation of what the writers were really trying to do with their poetry, creating Japanese art, something familiar to them, in their new foreign home.
We really wanted to have Japanese culture in desert in North America.
In what?
This desert, like nothing.
In the desert of North America.
They didn't have nothing to read in the U.S., no access to published books in the U.S., which is written in Japanese. So I think it's more like they wanted to have, when you are thirsty, you want to drink.
Many of the poems are written by Shinjiro Honda. Wakai comes across one that he wrote at the start of a new year.
Mr. Honda wrote, Hatsuyume no reniya wa fuji ni shite iwai.
He had a dream about a mountain that at first he thought was Mount Rainier, but really in his dream it was Mount Fuji in Japan, a mountain that is revered, a mountain from his home.
I think it's a very happy feeling of the dream. It's a very lucky dream.
For Paula, there are still so many questions she has that she would love to find the answers to.
The wealthy family that he worked for lived in the highlands. They don't have addresses, street addresses in the highlands. And so I'm not sure what house it was and if that house still stands. But I would love to find out if it does, and maybe just to be in a space that I knew he had been in. That would be amazing. I have lots of questions. I think I will keep chipping away at this one for a while because it really took hold of me. There's just so many bittersweet things about this story.
As the stone that was found in the backyard in Seattle revealed, Shinjiro Honda died on September 3rd, 1942. It happened at the Heart Mountain internment camp in Powell, Wyoming. He died of esophageal cancer only 3 days after arriving at the camp. He was 65. His remains are not under the stone in Wyoming. Someday, Paula hopes to visit the Heart Mountain Internment Camp Interpretive Center, and there she would like to find out more about Shinjiro Honda's only child. He had a daughter. If Paula can find her, or family members who knew her, then the location of Mr. Honda's final resting place might finally be known.
That story from Sound Effects, Jennifer Wayne. Today on Sound Effect, we're telling stories about missing pieces. We'd all like to think that, basically, we know who we are. But what if your DNA tells you something very different? Sound Effect contributor Alex Ashley brings us the story of what happens when finding those missing pieces changes how you think about yourself.
I don't remember exactly how she phrased it, but I remember my mother sitting me down when I was 13 years old. From a bench on the front porch of a double-wide, we overlooked a sprawling green lawn. There, she told me something that would change my life, my perspective on the world, forever. "Your father," she said, "he's not who you think he is. He's a black rock drummer from Southern California. His name is Saul. You can find him on the internet." This came as a surprise to me for many reasons, not the least of which was that I was raised as a white kid in a white family in a white town. My parents were best friends in their high school years, but never planned to get married or start a family. For most of my mom's life, and all of mine, my mother has dealt with addiction and mental health issues. So, from birth, I was raised by my maternal grandparents in Anacortes, Washington. As for my father, I did find him on the internet, found his phone number too, and 13-year-old me, sitting on a squeaky bed in a dusty spare room in the back of the trailer, called the man who was supposed to be my father.
"Hey,"
I said in my voicemail.
"I think there might be some way we're related. Anyway, give me a call back if you want."
Soon after, we finally met and did our best to catch up on the past 13 years. A couple years later, at my height of exuberant teenage rebellion, my grandparents sent me to live with my father in San Diego. Shortly after that, we got a letter in the mail from my father's biological mother. You see, without getting too personal, my father had been adopted from birth, and he'd never known his biological family. Patricia, his birth mother, came into our lives fast, and with her came answers. Whole chapters of our family history that were no longer redacted. It was like reading a sensitive document that had been declassified. Oh, one might think. So this is who I am. In the following years, my life felt more and more like a puzzle, the kind people sprawl across kitchen tables and glue together and hang on the wall when they're finished. Except there was one piece I could never find a place for, the identity of my paternal grandfather. Patricia, my dad's birth mother, told me what she remembered from the 1960s about my paternal grandfather. He was a black man named Lonnie. He was very handsome, she said, smooth with the ladies. They met when she lived in Champaign, Illinois. He played trumpet and sang the high parts in a soul band called the Nickel Bag that was popular at the time. I searched for Lonnie for years, hoping to uncover a picture or maybe someone who knew him. I don't know what drove my interest to find him, other than wanting to put the last piece to the puzzle where it belonged, to finally solve this mystery like I was in a Law & Order episode. But like most things that matter, it's hard to wrap a pretty little bow around it in 40 minutes before the credits roll. I came across a break in the case when I discovered HollywoodHangover.com, a website dedicated, as far as I can tell, to reminiscing over the music scene in the 60s and 70s in the Champaign-Urbana area. There was a post on there about my paternal grandfather's band, the Nickelback. Bill Bracken, the bass player and founder of the band, had written some of his memories of those days. As it turns out, Bill lives in Marysville, Washington, less than an hour from me. So while a break in the case on television may be cued by some sort of sting or a buildup of dramatic music, for me at least, it sounded like this.
"Hey, Bill.
Nice to finally meet
you in
person.
Yeah, nice to meet you too. How are you feeling?"
"Good."
I sat down with Bill, and we talked about his glory days as a band leader playing bass in the Nickel Bag. And what it was like to be the only white guy in a soul band in the Chicago area in the 60s and 70s. We talked about what it was like to tour with iconic bands of that era.
"Some of the best stuff happened in the summer of 1969. A tour with Steppenwolf for 8 concerts across the Midwest. We played with the Fifth Dimension, the Turtles, the Buckinghams, the Shadows of Night."
Then he starts to tell me what I'm really there for, to hear what I can about the missing piece to the puzzle.
"We had signed on with a booking agent, a guy named Bob Nutt. We wanted to get some better jobs, and we kept bugging him about it. And he said, well, look, he says, I'll get you better jobs, but here's the problem. I don't think you've got that little extra you need to push you over the top. You need a little something more. And so we said, well, what do you think we need? And he says, well, I think you need somebody that's, you know, can sing the high range and that's got, you know, maybe can play something else too. So
this is where my grandfather, Lonnie Bowman, comes in.
He suggested Lonnie Bowman, and Lonnie played really great trumpet and could really push the high end of the trumpet range. And he had a fantastic voice, pretty good dancer, and, you know, kind of a showy guy. So we got him in the band, and the combination worked. He was sort of high-strung. That's what I remember about him. He was touchy and high-strung, is the way I would say. But he also seemed to really be present. He was very there. Obviously had some great skills.
Did he have a hard time getting along with people in the band?
Sometimes. most of the time he was fine, but sometimes he did. He, like I say, was kind of touchy, and, you know, you never knew what was going to set him off, so.
I only know of one recording out there with my grandfather's voice on it, a vinyl record he cut with one of his bands after his time with Bill's band, the Nickelback. I have yet to hear it. I heard a lot of stories from Bill that day. He described a person whose blood I shared, but who I had never met. He told me what it was like sharing a station wagon with my grandfather and the band when they would play around the Midwest. What it was like yanking him off stage after a white audience member started yelling racial slurs at him. The musical thread runs strong in our family on my dad's side. The past three generations of men, myself included, have been professional musicians who've seen road time and depended on music to pay the bills. I started playing guitar at 8 years old, long before I ever knew any of that, so maybe music can run in the veins. I can see some of him in you, Bill said. It's subtle, but it's there. It wasn't quite the wrap-up you might see on network television, but it was a step in the right direction. All of this happened around the same time I got my results back from the lab. I had done one of those genealogy tests, where you spit into the vial and they tell you where you came from. The website matched me with a woman from Sacramento who was listed as my first cousin on my father's side. I emailed her. We went back and forth for a bit, and eventually I asked her, "Does the name Lonnie Bowman mean anything to you?" "Yeah," she said. "That was my father." It turned out that my father had not one but two half-sisters he never knew about. After his time with Patricia, my paternal grandmother, Lonnie moved on, started a family, had a different life. "Well, we knew," my Aunt Nicole said. "Really?" I asked. "Daddy always talked about how he thought he had a son out there," she replied. "We just never knew how to find him." She said for a time, as kids, while their dad was in the military, he was stationed in Fort Lewis. My dad grew up in Kirkland, which means he was 50 miles away from his biological family, and they never knew it. Several months later, on a tour down the West Coast, I stopped in Sacramento to meet my aunts, Nicole and Tiffany, for the first time.
Hey, it's me.
Hey.
You guys are 8101?
Yeah.
You got the puppy dog out in the front.
Oh, you're here.
I'm here.
Ah! Okay, here.
This will be interesting.
I didn't get much of this meeting on tape. It didn't seem like the right time to shove a microphone in their faces. But after this, we went inside. They showed me walls of family photos and odds and ends that belonged to my grandfather and gave me a sense of who he was, including pictures and scraps of paperwork from his time in Vietnam. I've stayed in touch with Nicole and Tiffany, aunts I never knew I had until now. But I'm never going to meet my grandfather, Lonnie Bowman. He passed away of leukemia in 2000. When I was talking to my grandparents about this, my mother's parents, the ones who raised me, my grandmother reminded me of something I had known but maybe forgotten. "Well," she said, "you know, your grandfather isn't who you think he is. He's not your mom's biological father. I met him after your mom was born."
Alex Ashley is a contributor to our show. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestead, Jennifer Wing, and Posey Gruner. Special thanks this week to Parker Miles Blom, Alex Ashley, and Dick Stein. Our executive producer is Aaron Hennessy. Our shows are shelf stable. They never go bad. You can dig deep into our archives when you subscribe to our podcast. We're on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, NPR One, all the places. Come on back next week when our theme is What is Normal? I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is KNKX.